I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, the 2024 race for the White House was Donald Trump against Joe Biden, and then it wasn't. It became Trump versus Kamala Harris. Did Biden step aside due to questions of age-related cognitive decline, or was he pushed out because of bad polling numbers? Was Harris the only option to take over that campaign? What would a fight for that nomination have looked like at the Democratic National Convention? Would that have torn the party apart? Harris had 107 days to try to beat the Republican Party and Trump 3.0. Was that just too much to ask in too little time? What decisions could have changed history and kept Trump from getting back into power? Best-selling authors Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnas deliver the inside stories in their new book, Fight Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House. Call in at 833-877-8255. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Today, Donald Trump is president of the United States, the most powerful man on the planet. He got there by winning the 2024 presidential election, but how did he do that? Were there major decisions that he made, either him or his campaign, that locked in that win? How did Harris eventually become the Democrats' last hope to try to stop Trump? And could that have gone differently? What missteps did the vice president make along the way? A new book brings us inside the campaigns, and that brought us to where we are right now. Fight Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House. We're joined by the two co-authors, Jonathan Allen, an award-winning political reporter for NBC News. Jonathan, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
And Amy Parnes, she is the senior political correspondent covering national politics for The Hill. Amy, welcome to The Source.
Thank you for having us.
I'm going to ask both of you the same question, see if you give me different answers. Let's start off with Amy. Did Trump win the election or did Harris lose the election?
I think Trump ran a much better campaign than he had in the past, a tighter campaign. He had a good message. He changed the playbook a little bit, whereas Democrats were relying on things that they had done in the past in terms of fundraising and grassroots efforts. I think he had done all of that in a smarter, more fresh way. And I think Kamala Harris could have won had she tweaked her campaign, had she had a message, and the list goes on and on.
All right. So, Jonathan Allen, you call it Trump 3.0. This is his third campaign for president. So do you go with that answer? Do you think Trump won, not so much that Harris lost, or how does that work?
David, it's a good question. I'm not sure that there is, at least from my perspective, a perfect answer to that in terms of, you know, obviously there's zero sum when it comes to the actual set of people who go out and vote. But I think there were things that the Democrats did, and I would put both President Biden and Vice President Harris in that. You know, the Democratic campaign had two leaders to it over the course of time. You know, there were things that they could have done better. There were mistakes that they made. We detail a lot of that in the book. And at the same time, Amy's absolutely right that President Trump ran a much better, tighter campaign this time around. I think ultimately, we have such very close elections, so clearly polarized and divided along party lines. So it only takes a small shift to change who's the winner. But I think that a lot of the people who are voting wanted change, and President Trump offered a certain kind of change that we're now seeing. And it was not clear to, I think, a lot of voters how Kamala Harris would have been markedly different in terms of her agenda or her ability to deliver on that agenda than President Biden had been.
Our phone lines are open, and we put that question to our listeners. Do you think Trump won the election or Harris lost the election? How do you feel about how this election went down? 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. What do you think were the major moments that set this election into this victory for Trump. We do have a voicemail that has their response to the question.
Hi, this is Amy. To the question, I think the answer is America lost. I couldn't believe people fear for snake oil salesman after experiencing the first term. And he lost in 2020 while in power. He tried so hard to control the Department of Justice. I don't want to get into that. But he tried so, put pressure on election officials 2020 to change the vote. He convicted in a criminal case and a civil case. There are so many things I can mention, but I'm going to stop because thank you.
All right, so that was Amy, and let's go to Amy, the co-author of the book Fight. So she brings up the fact that Trump had all of these negatives. You know, he was convicted. He was he'd been impeached twice. He had all those controversies on him. How come he was able to shed that, Amy?
Because he was able to connect with voters. He was able to get in touch with what voters wanted specifically on the economy, on immigration, on these key issues. And as I mentioned before, I felt like Kamala Harris and even Joe Biden before her, they weren't able to successfully tap into what voters really wanted. It was almost like they were focused on too many aspects and didn't really home in on and connect with voters on the issues they cared about.
So I want to play a clip here. This is from when Vice President Kamala Harris was on The View. You have pointed to this moment as a make or break moment for Harris, and it didn't go well. Let's give a listen.
Well, if anything, would you have done something differently than President Biden during the past 4 years?
There is not a thing that comes to mind in terms of, and I've been a part of most of the decisions that have had impact.
All right. So, Jonathan Allen, why was that such a significant moment?
I think it was significant because, you know, let's start with the context of President Biden. And as we report in this book, and I think it was, you know, a lot of Democratic voters didn't know this, but the Democratic leadership, most of the Democratic leaders, believed that Joe Biden was losing to Donald Trump significantly before the debate that precipitated Biden's exit. So let's start with that context of Biden and the Democrats were in a position of trailing Trump. And as a result of that, you know, you sort of try to figure out what it is when you have a new candidate that comes in that can distinguish herself from a president who is losing to his opponent and, you know, according to approval rating polls, you know, was less popular than popular. So in order for her to win, she's got to tell people how she's different from the guy who is currently unpopular and losing to the rival. And, you know, in that moment, there are a couple different ways she could express being different. One is, of course, had she had a different record than President Biden, but of course she'd been vice president for 4 years, and had not, you know, had not broken from him significantly in any way, and I don't think anybody's surprised by that. But there she said it, you know, so affirmatively that she wouldn't have done anything differently in hindsight than President Biden had, basically embracing the entirety of his record in one sentence. And, you know, at the same time, she had not offered an agenda, you know, a vision for the country, particularly an economic agenda that was significantly different from Biden. She had some of the same people advising her that Biden had advising him on the economy. And so, you know, again, the public was looking for change and maybe in some cases looking for radical change. People were worried about the economy. They were worried about physical security, you know, sort of the basic needs of human beings, and the Democrats were not able, first Biden and then Harris, able to really articulate a way to take care of those needs, including doing something about the rising inflation, which we've continued to see, of course, during the Trump administration. I think, you know, the reason that's such a big moment is just people were waiting to hear what
it
is.
It was teed up for her, and yeah, she whiffed.
She
didn't happen. I'm going to take a break here.
Not so, have that answer.
Yeah, we're going to take a break. Our phone lines are open. What do you think decided the election for and made Trump president? 833-877-8255. The Source continues right after this.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The book is Fight Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House. We're joined by the two co-authors, Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes. Both are veteran reporters on the national political scene. And you can call in with your questions and comments about that political race, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Here's another clip. It is painful to listen to, and this is from the Biden and Trump debate, and this could be the most significant and worst performance of a candidate in a presidential debate. Let's give a listen.
What I'm going to do is fix the tax system. For example, we have 1,000 trillionaires in America, billionaires in America. And what's happening? They're in a situation where they, in fact, pay 8.2% in taxes. If they just paid 24%, 25%, either one of those numbers, they'd raise $500 million, billion dollars, I should say, in a 10-year period. We'd be able to wipe out his debt. We'd be able to help make sure that all those things we need to do, child care, elder care, making sure that we continue to strengthen our health care system, making sure that we're able to make every single solitary person eligible for what I've been able to do with the dealing with everything we have to do with, look, if we finally beat Medicare.
Thank you, President Biden. President Trump?
Well, he's right. He did beat Medicare. He beat it to death, and he's destroying Medicare.
Jonathan Allen, and then I'll go to Amy, get your reaction to that. What are your thoughts when you hear all that?
I mean, the first thing is that it's scary. It's scary that the leader of the free world, even momentarily, seems so bereft of coherent thought. I think, you know, my other thought is that it's sad that Joe Biden is somebody who has spent a lot of time in public life, somebody who has dedicated himself to public service, somebody who I think, you know, a lot of people look to as a very moral man, and to watch him, you know, be subjected to that or subject himself to it is sad. And then, you know, as I was watching it at the time, of course, I'm a political reporter, and you know, my third thought was, what are the politics of this? And I didn't have to wait long to find out, because my phone was blowing up, just like as we report in this book, just like what's going on throughout the media landscape and throughout the Democratic universe. Certainly, I think it was probably happening on the Republican side too. But you know, influential Democrats were you know, in full out panic mode. You know, having watched not just that moment, but you know, Biden gingerly walking into the debate studio that night and several of his other answers. So perhaps the most, I'm not even sure. I mean, who knows what happens in the future? I was going to say it's the most consequential debate moment of my lifetime for certain.
It looked like elder abuse having that debate. Amy, your reaction to witnessing that, hearing that clip again, and tell us more about what was happening behind the scenes.
Yeah, it was shocking. I mean, mostly because John and I have both covered him for so long. I've covered him since he was a senator. And just seeing him in that state was concerning. But also, you know, we had asked questions. I know the press is blamed for, or a lot of people have come after the press in recent months for, you know, trying to hide this. We had done our jobs in trying to figure out what was going on with him. So it wasn't completely shocking, but just in that moment, I think a lot of people felt like, well, he's not able to run this race. And there was this uncertainty building even that evening of, well, who would take over? And that was happening right away in a way that I have never observed before in politics. Usually things take a little longer to unravel. This was unraveling within seconds of that clip you just played.
Yeah, the world changed during that debate. Let's go to a caller. Our number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. And let's go to Tiffany. And Tiffany, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to answer your guys' question about did Trump win or did Harris lose? I think it's pretty obvious that Trump won and Harris lost. I think both are very, very true, especially when Trump won swing states and Harris lost a lot of minority groups. So I think the answer is yes.
All right, Tiffany. And so, Jonathan, the Democrats win by having a coalition. And it does seem like that coalition frayed apart, if not just completely fell apart, during that campaign. Was that a deliberate, or the result of a deliberate attack by the Republicans?
I mean, I think there were a variety of things going on between 20 and 2024. Among the electorate. And, you know, so one of them is that President Trump makes a very concerted effort to appeal to men and to appeal to young men, to appeal to young men of color, and to do so using effectively the same, you know, the same agenda and the same messaging that he is for the rest of the electorate. And I think what, you know, what we see, and particularly among Hispanic voters, is a real change and a real desire to focus on economic issues. I think that the Democrats seem to believe that that they are going to win Hispanic voters by arguing that that undocumented immigrants, you know, shouldn't be deported, or, you know, to basically having a softer line on immigration. And I think Trump's views of immigration actually resonated better with Hispanic voters broadly, not all Hispanic voters, obviously, but certainly with some Hispanic voters than they had in the past. So I think there was a concerted effort on Trump's part. On the other hand, you've seen a change in the Democratic coalition, a significant change, which is that it used to be a more big D Democratic coalition. And what you've seen over the course of recent years is it has changed to incorporate the disaffected anti-Trump Republicans. And those folks who have been absorbed into the Democratic Party have an influence on it and have, you know, moved its policy making a little bit. And I think it becomes a little bit more like the Republican Party, the part of the Republican Party that Donald Trump beat to become the Republican nominee in 2016 and to stay there, obviously, in 2020 when he was president, and again in 2024. So I think there are a few different things going on with the electorate, all at the same time. Like the caller said, to the either or question, the answer is yes.
Right. Let's go to another caller, Tiffany. And Tiffany, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. I was calling because I had heard your comment about Harris coming in and not having an economic plan to put forward, and that she mimicked Joe Biden. My issue was with the Democratic Party, period, that they put her and threw her to the wolves with about 3.5 months left to prepare. I thought that was a huge error. And in lieu of them throwing her into preparing for the presidential candidate as a Democratic candidate, that she did quite well in comparison to Hillary Clinton, who prepared for the campaign with a lot of time that she had. So I really think this was an issue with the Democratic Party, just their lack of preparedness. Thank you.
Thank you, Tiffany. So, Amy Parnes, was Kamala Harris set up to fail?
In a sense, yes, because she couldn't run her own campaign. I mean, of course, she was on the ticket, but these weren't her people. These were Joe Biden's people. And when she's finally the candidate, she's essentially inheriting his setup and his structure and his his operation, his entire operation, including his campaign chairman on down. And she brings her own people in, but they are sort of relegated, like, off to the side in their own room. They're not really, they're incorporated in some ways, but cast away in other ways. And so it wasn't the most seamless operation, especially with nearly just over 100 days left. So in some ways, yes, I do think that she, you know, this, she wasn't given any favors. She wasn't, she had to make the best of what she inherited.
So, Jonathan, could there have been a different nominee? Could someone else become the Democratic banner holder?
I mean, certainly someone else could have, in a, you know, theoretical sense. I don't see a practical situation in which that would have happened. You know, there were Democrats like President Obama who wanted to have some sort of mini primary leading to an open convention to replace Biden. But I think it's important to remember that Joe Biden had won about 90% of the delegates on a ticket that was Biden and Harris. And that Biden, you know, these are people who were pledged to support the Biden-Harris ticket. Specifically, it was Joe Biden's people who are delegates to the Democratic Convention. So I think, you know, his word means a lot in that. I also think that the Democrats were rightly, Democratic leaders were rightly concerned that if they had tried to skip over a vice president who was the first Black woman to sit in that spot, that there would have been such a fracturing of the Democratic Party that it might have relegated them to defeat for two or three or four presidential cycles. And the reason that I say that is the most loyal set of voters in the Democratic Party are Black women. And, you know, to basically engineer a new process in order to deny the vice president the ability to ascend into that role of nominee, I think would have really ripped the Democratic Party apart at the seams. Now, arguably the Democratic Party has been ripped apart at the seams anyway, but probably not as badly as it would have been.
When we see that the Democratic parties, that the brand is toxic now, that's the conventional wisdom. You think that's because of this campaign, Amy?
I think it definitely led to it. But I think this has been a problem for Democrats over the course of the last maybe decade. I think that, you know, of course they won in 2020, but I think they have a larger problem when it comes to their messaging, and they've lost their way. A lot of these people who supported Trump should be Democrats. And for whatever reason, they were more attracted to the Republican Party and to Trump than they were to Democrats. But these are people that traditionally would be Democrats. And I find that the most interesting part of this election, almost, because these are people who have felt, you know, that were cast away in a sense from the Democratic Party. And what the Democratic Party needs to do right now is to try to connect with these voters and almost to admit what went wrong. I think there is this tendency for the Democratic Party to not, in their autopsies of losses, to not really absorb what actually happened, what they did wrong, and admit what they did wrong. And that's sort of the key to moving forward.
Well, the word gaslight, I don't know how many times it appears in the book, but you talk about how there was an attempt to gaslight voters, Democrats, about the economy, about Joe Biden's fitness to run for office and be president, and also about Kamala Harris's ability to win the election. And so I wonder, you know, now that the gas has cleared from all that gaslighting, maybe that's why, Democrats are having such a hard time coming back together, whipping up a head of steam to try to win elections. We're going to talk more about that when we come back from the break, about the news that there's news in the book about how Barack Obama was not supportive of Kamala Harris. And you've already mentioned that, Jonathan. We'll get more into that and some of the other details. One on Joe Rogan, how Kamala Harris was not able to get on Joe Rogan and how big of a deal that was. And our phone lines are open. We've got some callers. Michael, we'll get you on the air coming back from the break. 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The new book is Fight, Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House. The Source continues right after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Fight, Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House. It's a new book by Jonathan Allen and Amy Parnes. And it is, you know, after every major campaign, these blame books come out about how the elections were lost, what was happening back, you know, all the backstabbing backstage behind closed doors. This is one of those that tells you a lot about what was happening throughout that election, stuff that we didn't hear about and maybe we should have heard about before the votes were cast. You can call in with questions and comments, 833-877-8255. Let's go to Michael. And Michael, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you, David, and thank you to your guests. I was just going to say that what happened in President Trump's campaign is he took the opportunity to start to pit people against each other by placing society into categories where the most important person in the country under his regime was going to be, you know, billionaire male U.S. citizens. And then everybody would come under that. So, you know, people who are Hispanic but are here as citizens would then be above people who are not here as citizens but are here legally. And so he kind of placed a hierarchy of importance on everybody. And that ended up where people were voting and looking, well, if I vote for this man, who am I going to get to be above? And I think that really kind of pit us against each other, men above women, people who are citizens above non-citizens, non-citizens who are here legally above illegal immigrants and that sort of thing. Thank you.
All right, Michael, thank you for that. Was that a strategy? Was that just Trump's instinct, pitting people against each other? Jonathan?
I mean, I think Trump, like many politicians, is somebody who wants to seek contrast between himself and his opponents. And he understands that fear is a powerful motivator for voters. And whether that is fear of Democrats or whether it is fear of their neighbors, it is something that has sustained him as a candidate, helped him build his base. And it says something, I think, about, you know, where the electorate is and what matters most and to the electorate, or at least did in 2024. I think we were very much in a place as a country where there was fear about the future, fear about particularly economic security, which is, you know, which is the most basic human need, you know, food, shelter, you know, the ability to provide for yourself and your family. These are the basic human needs, and a lot of fear about whether people were going to be able to do that. And, you know, Trump played to that. And I think when people feel more comfortable in their economic situation, then that's when other emotions become more powerful, say, for example, hope.
Amy Parnes, a lot of people thought that the abortion issue would propel Harris to victory. It did not. What happened to that?
I think they wanted it to be an issue that that connected with voters. And for some people, you know, they were really moved by abortion. So I don't want to downplay that. But I think there were other issues that were really important to other parts of the electorate. And the economy, let's face it, was really the biggest issue facing voters. And I think for the most part, people went to the ballot with the economy, with inflation on their minds, with all of those things, you know, the basically making ends meet. The economy, this was an economic election. And I think that that's why she suffered.
The groceries, as Trump likes to talk about, the groceries. Let's go to Randall on the phones. And Randall, you're on the air.
That clip you played earlier from the debate highlights a major problem we have to tackle as a nation, and that is mental acuity and age in the presidency. We have two very old white guys that have been battling out for the past three elections. And do either of them have any business being in the Oval Office right now? A year and a half ago, well, in July of 2023, The Independent published an article, "Let's Fact-Check Biden's So-Called Mental Decline." The article goes on the defensive about Biden's age and cognitive issues. 18 months later, just this past December, there was a big report in the Wall Street Journal that aides from the Biden administration admitted that they had been employing a variety of strategies to hide Biden's declining mental acuity from the public almost from the first day of his presidency. I feel like this was the Kobayashi Maru for Democrats, a no-win scenario. Is it time for us to have a constitutional amendment that sets an upper age limit for the presidency, now that we know what we know through science and research about things like Alzheimer's I can't think of the thing right now because I'm
just regular dementia, age-related cognitive decline.
Exactly. Yes, we have to address that, I think.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that. By the way, on the day of the debate, we did a program about age-related cognitive decline, talking about the debate, telling listeners, viewers, watch for age-related cognitive decline in both of these candidates because it is going to be a major issue in the campaign. But what about, Jonathan, Alan, what about our caller's comments?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the I think that there are a lot of people who would prefer if a next generation than after the baby boom generation took power relatively soon. I think the caller's right. You need a constitutional amendment to put in an age limit. There is another constitutional amendment that provides for the removal of a president by the vice president and a majority of the cabinet, if they deem that he or she is no longer capable of doing that job. But the problem is the person that benefits from that most is the vice president. There's not really a system that works that doesn't create some pretty perverse incentives, at least as it stands. So maybe that's something that that Congress will look at some point. I think it'd be hard to get a two-thirds majority for that in both chambers for a constitutional amendment.
Especially since they're all pretty much that age, too.
Fair enough. I think it's a discussion that's going to be had, but my guess is that we're probably going to end up in pretty much the same place, which is it's going to be the voters, the voters who decide whether a candidate is too old or has declined too much to be the president.
Yeah, there's all these comments about, Biden's cognitive decline and these issues and how terrible it was that the White House had covered up for him. But of course, every White House always covers up for a president who has some sort of issue, whether it be Jack Kennedy or what have you. Now we have Trump and either they are doing the same or they will be doing the same for him. So just to be aware of that, Amy. Should that be fair game?
I'm sorry, I missed part of the question.
Should, these snipes that are shot at Biden for his cognitive decline, yeah, and accusing the White House of covering up for him and that being a terrible thing. I mean, clearly we just watching Trump speaking yesterday about his tariffs and just spouting off a lot of this mistruths that seem like, unhinged. I mean, yeah. What about that? I mean, that seemed like somebody who had cognitive decline speaking as well.
Yeah. And this should absolutely be fair game. I mean, this is the thing about journalism and covering a president. You have to call balls and strikes when you see them. And that's something, we live in a fractured media environment right now. And so there's an unwillingness to do that. But I do think that reporters should hold whoever's in office accountable. And, President Trump should be under the same scrutiny as Biden was. If he misspeaks or says anything that's untrue, he should be called out for it.
So, Jonathan, what was the election about? So you're saying it was about groceries or the price of eggs, and but still the economy was great.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that I agree with that. Exactly. I mean, the economy is complicated, and the economy, any economy, is good for some people and bad for others. I think inflation was a problem, and it was a problem that the Biden administration and Joe Biden himself denied for a long time. At first, they said there was no inflation. Then they said inflation was transitory. They seemed to be ignoring the concerns of a public that saw the price tag on a lot of, you know, a lot of necessary goods going up. So, you know, the economy can be good in terms of the metrics of growth overall, and in terms of the metrics of the unemployment rate and a variety of other indicators, where, you know, broadly speaking, the economy is doing well. But that does not mean that everybody is benefiting from it. And in some cases, inflation is a particularly perilous political problem because everyone feels it. Whether you're buying a mega yacht or you are buying milk, you see the sticker shock. And I think that's something that the Biden administration was slow to respond to. I think it's something that Biden did not really, as a candidate, have a solution for. And it's something that Vice President Harris didn't have a solution for. And as we see, you know, Donald Trump had the sort of benefit of being out of office, right? And being able to claim that whatever he would do would stop inflation. He said it would stop on day one. But because he was not the person in office, him making that argument is not, you know, as easily testable as what's going on with the people who are currently in office. As we've seen, inflation has continued.
It's probably going to get a lot worse.
Dow Jones Industrial right now, average right now, you know, cratering down 3% today. You know, there are a whole lot of promises that Donald Trump made on the economy that he has not kept to this point. But that doesn't mean that voters who were concerned about their own economic situation did not see a change to him as a better option than sticking with basically the status quo.
Taking a break. We'll be back in 1 minute. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Fight inside the wildest battle for the White House. This is The Source. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. Jonathan Allen, an award-winning political reporter for NBC News. Amy Parnes, a senior political correspondent covering national politics for The Hill. They work together on these books about the post-election autopsies. The latest one, Fight Inside the Wildest Battle for the White House, looking at what happened with Trump, Biden, and Kamala Harris. Let's go to a caller. We have Jack. And let's get Jack on the air. Jack, go ahead.
Yeah. I'm a retired naval warrant officer, and I also retired from a newspaper and as a photojournalist. You started off by talking about how Trump won and how Kamala Harris lost. I believe that that Trump, well, for one thing, I believe that Musk's infusion of a $250 million did a lot to buy this election for Trump. And there was a lot of voter suppression going on. There were tactics being spread to take Democrat voters out of the equation.
All right, and, Jack, we got your point, and I thank you for your call. Appreciate it. So, Amy Parnes, let me ask you about Elon Musk. Joining Trump on a campaign trail, him giving away money to people to vote for Trump, and now he is an active part of the administration. How significant of a role did you think Musk actually had?
I mean, quite significant, because coming out of the election, you can see the role he was given. That's no coincidence. He's someone that President Trump values. And I've been told from people close to the White House and inside the White House that you shouldn't expect him to go anywhere, despite these reports that have come out in the last couple of days saying that, you know, he's on his way out. I think the president has a great deal of respect for him, and obviously he's going to continue to play a big role in financing the Republican Party and in various roles with the White House.
Jonathan Allen, Trump was shot at. He was wounded in the ear in Butler, Pennsylvania. Did that play? I watched that on TV, and I couldn't say, what's going on? You know, it's crazy watching it live. And so did that, you know, really help boost his campaign?
I mean, I think, you know, as we report in the book, Democratic operatives, including some on the Biden campaign, saw the assassination of attempt on President Trump and thought the election was over at that moment. Of course, things changed. Democrats changed candidates. There was sort of a reset there. But, you know, if you look back in American history, there have, of course, been assassinations of presidents. It has been a long time since anything that horrific has happened, in certainly in a presidential election or with anyone, you know, regarding a current or former president. You know, the only other time in my lifetime was President Reagan in 1981, who was shot and fortunately survived. But as did Trump, you know, with good fortune survived. You know, you kind of have to take that moment out of the political to appreciate just, you know, how dark and insane that is, and then put it back in the political, because it is part of Trump's story. It is part of his comeback from 2021, when, you know, not only the Democrats, not only independents, but many Republicans wanted to have nothing to do with him. You know, his supporters had just stormed the United States Capitol. He had tried to overturn a fair election. And, you know, I think one of the sort of sort of underappreciated assessments of the Democrats is that, you know, in order for Trump to come back, you know, it's a stunning indictment on their ability to figure out how to prevent him from coming back, because he, you know, he had had this this effort to overturn the election. He had been indicted four times. He had been convicted in New York on felony charges. But I think fairly, he looks at his last 4 years and thinks whether or not, that, you know, these things are his fault, and some of them are, that he had overcome so much, perhaps more than anybody else, overcome more odds to get to the point where he was. And then someone takes a shot at him and you know, misses the, you know, areas where that would have been fatal. So, you know, he'd been hit in the head, potentially fatal, you know, by such a small margin. This is really part of his political story.
It's American history now.
Well, and if you look at it from the perspective of Trump supporters, and particularly the folks who were close to him, they feel like he's endured more than anybody else. And that is, you know, one of the important pieces of that narrative and that trajectory. And I think it's something that is underappreciated by his opponents, by his rivals, the extent to which people who have stuck with Trump have seen him beat the odds over and over and over again, and find that to be an attractive quality, not only as a candidate, but in a president, as they hope that, you know, presidents of the United States are able to pull off miracles.
Amy Parnes, Joe Rogan, Harris, yeah, was trying to get on Joe Rogan. What happened? Mm-hmm.
So I think she realized, and her campaign realized rather quickly, that podcasts matter in this election. They saw what their opponent was doing on the other side and attracting attention, particularly from men. So there was this effort to try to get her on the Joe Rogan Experience. It's one of the most highly sought after podcasts, has a lot of listeners. And they tried over several weeks to get her on there, so much so that they moved an entire rally to Texas. They created an entire rally in October. You just don't do that. And people at the time were scratching their heads and saying, why is she doing a rally in Texas? And no one really knew the answer.
So it was in Houston on a Friday night.
Exactly.
Now, and this is during high school football season.
Right. Right.
Okay.
In Texas.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
There's a cultural gap there that needed to be filled. Not good.
Yeah, I mean, understatement. Yes. And so they built this entire rally really to be within a close proximity to where Joe Rogan broadcasts his and records his podcast. And of course, you know, they keep negotiating and it doesn't happen. You know, and her people blame him for not being forthcoming about, you know, various dates and all. We write about all of this in the book, but it was really interesting to see.
It seemed like a management issue that they should have worked that out, been able to figure that out. And they didn't recognize that Joe Rogan was the one that had the leverage. So they should have been trying to work with him on that. But so this book, it's really interesting if you're looking to figure out like what went wrong for the next presidential election. A lot of insight into that. But I wonder, Jonathan Allen, if Donald Trump is going to be reading this book for his next presidential election as we're talking about trying to forget about the 22nd Amendment. What are your thoughts?
Well, I certainly want everyone to read the book. So the president is welcome to do that. You know, he is not ruled out trying to find a way to be on the ballot in 2028. You know, there are reasons to not rule that out, even if you aren't planning on attempting to run for, you know, a third term, you know, most notably that you prevent yourself from becoming a lame duck instantly. You know, I think time has shown us that it is a mistake to listen to what Donald Trump says and you know, that sounds outlandish and think that he's kidding. So I take very seriously and will continue to try to report on efforts to find a way for him to continue on in the presidency beyond when this term comes to an end in January 29, 2029. Of course, you know, he is also getting up there in age. We were talking about Joe Biden's mental acuity earlier, and you know, who knows what President Trump looks like 4 years from now, physically and mentally. You know, I take it very seriously, and I, you know, the people who are supporting that idea even describe what they're looking at as a loophole. And so my question is whether the American public, particularly independent voters, would be willing to stomach that. I mean, there is a constitutional limitation, but there's also a political limitation. And the political limitation is if Donald Trump isn't extraordinarily popular 4 years from now, it's hard for me to imagine that he would be rewarded by voters for finding a way around the Constitution.
Amy Parnes, I've got about 40 seconds here. I mean, what advice should someone take away from this book if, you know, the next Democrat running for the White House?
That's the thing is this book not only offers what went wrong, but it offers a playbook for going forward. And I think both parties can benefit from it. I think Democrats can learn what went wrong and what they can do better. Republicans can build upon what they did successfully and what didn't go so well either. But we very much wrote this book to look ahead to, not just to look back.
And the book is Fight Inside the Wildest or the Nuttiest or the Most Painful Battle for the White House. Jonathan Allen, Amy Parnes, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.